My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
Hey, I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is not a regular episode of The Big Story. This is A Taste of Black Tea. If you listen to us, you know Andre Demise, writer for Maclean's, The Globe and Mail, many other places. And you'll meet his co-host, Milena Williams, also a writer for Flair.com, for Maclean's, for any number of places I could name. But together, they give you the most incisive criticism about race and culture in this country that you will hear anywhere. We've talked about it enough when we have Andre on our podcast, so we wanted you to hear it for yourself. So please have a listen to this interview with Sajay Elder on respectability politics. And if you like it, subscribe. You can find Black Tea on frequencypodcastnetwork.com, or if you're using Apple or a similar app, you can scroll down to other shows from Frequency. So I hope you enjoy, and we'll talk soon.
Hello and welcome to Black Tea, the podcast where we get to have amazing and uncomfortable conversations that concern Canada's Black communities. And the way this usually goes is that we start off a segment where we talk about things that make us happy, then we get into the real good stuff, and then afterwards we spill the tea.
Today we're going to talk about respectability politics.
Whether you want to call it fix up or clean professional appearance or pull up your pants, the fact is that the politics of respectability has a strong presence in Black communities. And what it boils down to is the way that we believe that we should present ourselves in public. So here to help us work through the issue, we've got writer and digital producer Sajay Elder. Sajay, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we're obviously going to talk about respectability politics. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I find that it's a really cumbersome academic term. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking to real people about real things, how would you define respectability politics?
Just the ways that we alter our behavior, essentially around white people.
Right.
The ways that we kind of police ourselves, essentially, or, you know, say this way or behave in this particular way to appease the larger white majority.
Yeah. And I find that, like, the way that we do it is really, like, we're taught this. I find that I was kind of raised that way. And the way that we understand it in public with each other is like, we get what we have to do to basically survive.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that we have to be respectable in front of people?
I think code switching is a really big one, a really important one. Differentiating how you can speak with whom. You probably speak to your friends with a little bit more slang than you might with your parents or boss or with your coworkers, stuff like that. Definitely switches up depending on what kind of space you're in.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's necessary and it's kind of like a means of survival, I guess. But that's one big way for sure. You know, the ways that you wear your hair, wearing it natural versus not wearing it natural, the way that you dress, more or less casual. Right. Yeah, there's a lot of things.
On code switching, because I find that when I do it, I'm so hyper aware of it. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a long time. So like, if I go into a new work environment, it's almost like a game. So I'm like, okay, who am I going to act like today? Am I going to be funny? Am I going to be bitchy? Like, am I going to show them that I'm this like strong Black woman that can do anything? So do you feel like it makes sense? Or do you feel like we should do away with it altogether?
I think that there's levels to it. Like, I think that there's always going to be spaces where you do kind of have to, like, you know, figure out like, what the sweet spot is in terms of, like, how to appease the most people. I don't know if we should do away with it. I think we might have to redefine what it looks like for us and what it looks like for individual people instead of just being like, okay, well, I have to be completely buttoned up, no slang, no, you know what I mean? No kind of parts of my real personality come out when I'm around certain kinds of people. There's ways to still be authentic, but still be professional. Like I can't talk the way that I talk to my friends, the way that I talk to my boss, but that doesn't mean that I have to be like, hello, sorry, thank you. So, like, you know what I mean? Like there's a professional me that's still me that I can be without being a complete fraud.
With your career, like your writing is really powerful and a lot of the things you do in the digital space is so authentic. And I'm just wondering if you have any anecdotes or stories when you had to put your foot down and be yourself.
I feel like I'm lucky enough because I am freelance and I don't have to work like in an office space where I'm negotiating those things really that much. The only thing that really comes to mind is I had this internship at a music management company and we were in this boardroom and one of the bosses was like just talking about basically about respectability politics, but he was like using different terminology, talking about like, I'm a chameleon. I can like blend into any space. Mm. Like if I need to be white, I should be white. If I need to, and I'm like, whoa.
Wait, was this a white dude?
He was definitely a black Jamaican man. So.
Oh God, no.
He's like that guy in that character in Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And and then
the
right, and then he was just like, if you were in a space, like, would you be willing to like cut your dreads or whatever? And I'm just why would I do that?
And why are you encouraging this, gentlemen?
Like, first of all, and at that point, my dreads had just got a little bit of hang time. I'm just like, who is cutting them?
Right.
I just started flicking them like yesterday. Who's cutting them?
But what kind of, for that person, what made him make that a part of his presentation? Like, how is that appropriate?
I don't even know because, and it was weird because we had like a really diverse team that we were working with. So like there were people in the room that weren't black. So I'm just like, I feel like this conversation is kind of weird.
Well, but, it's the performance probably.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
wants to show that he's that Negro.
Right, 100%. You know, it works for him, but it's not guanting for me still.
Well, you bring up the hair aspect of it and we laugh about it, but it actually means, you know, the difference between having a job and not having a job.
100%.
A couple of years ago, there was a waitress working downtown, a black woman, that wore her natural hair to work and she was asked to go home. So how do you square that? I mean, this is just the way that hair grows out of your head. How did we end up in a space where we allowed that to be politicized?
Yeah, I definitely think that obviously wearing your hair natural is not a new thing, but I think for so long, like we had kind of acquiesced to like, okay, we're going to relax our hair or blow dry it or whatever we're doing for so long that I think that over the last 15, 20 years, as so many more black women are wearing their hair natural, it's starting to become this conversation now because I feel like in days past, we would have just like sighed and be like, all right, well, pass me the dark and lovely box. And, you know what I mean? Like, and that's just what it was. But now I think there's so many of us that are choosing to wear hair natural that it's just kind of, I think there's just so much more friction about it now. Like, I remember I used to work at a hair store and the owner was like, yo, like, we can't move relaxers off the shelves anymore. Like, I have stock sitting for months. And my, like, women, we're just not buying them anymore.
Yeah, that's great.
So, which is dope, which is amazing. Yeah. But I think a lot more of those stories are going to happen because we're starting to realize, like, this thing can literally eat paint off a lot. Like, you can dissolve an entire body in lye.
Yeah.
And you're putting that on your scalp. Like, ooh.
And it's also like, you know, blackness is a politic. Black women's hair is always going to be political.
100%.
Everything we do is a political act, fortunately or unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to be engaging in these sort of conversations around identity, we have to know that, like, yeah, we're making deliberate political choices and some people may not be okay with it.
I made a joke a couple seconds ago about black men being the weakest link, but I think to some extent, black men in the workplace have been so heavily subsumed that we don't even really realize it. For example, you know, the way that we wear our hair in the workplace and that we speak, act, and talk in the workplace. I'm not going to say that it's like catering to, you know, white-centric standards, but I will say that, for example, how often do you ever see a black man in a professional workplace that's got long-ish hair or wears dreads that isn't stuck inside of like the suit and tie modality? Like there's, we've been so heavily invested in like the way that the corporate workplace is supposed to work that we kind of forgot to be ourselves.
Yeah, I feel like the black men that I have seen in sort of those super businessy environments who have chosen to wear their hair natural or chosen to wear dreads, it seems like resistance. And, you know, a lot of the time they probably are just trying to exist. It's something to be, you know, congratulated, but it's also just like black people existing.
Taking it out of the workplace for a second, what about, you know, where it comes to school? Like, I don't know any black male that hasn't gone through this sort of like being made to feel like the exception where white people will say like, oh, you know, like I'm blacker than you. Or if you're a geek, you have different kinds of interests outside of, let's say, like basketball and hip hop. They'll say that it like makes you less black. And then it becomes like a minefield of do I like certain things or not like certain things? Is it taking me away from my identity? You know, I can't speak to what that's like for black women, but I feel like there's a certain line of respectability that we're taught, you know, inside of classrooms in the schoolyard as well.
I definitely, you know, remember that growing up. I was lucky enough to move to the suburbs, but I moved to the suburbs at the time when, like, hella black people moved to Ajax at the same time.
Yeah.
So yeah. I never had that experience. Even though I grew up in the burbs, like, I never had that experience of, like, being the only black girl or, like, I always had, you know, peers my age to hang out with. I don't know. I never really had that weird identity thing that a lot of black suburban kids I know have.
Yeah.
But I feel a bit conflicted on in terms of, like, the whole having, I guess, non-traditionally, quote-unquote, black interests. I knew so many black people that were into anime or rock or whatever.
Yeah.
So, like,
And it's another way to say, like, I'm different than these other black people. Like, it ends up devolving.
And that's the thing, too. Like, like, for example, like, if I meet an adult who claims that, like, they don't have black friends now because...
I think they're funny.
Well, like, the black people didn't like me back in the day because I like Red Hot Chili Peppers. Right. It's like, bro, everyone likes Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's like still having dreams about in grade eight when you're an adult. It's time to move on.
I kind of think that when black people talk about getting made fun of, quote unquote, for certain things, I'm just like, was it because of that or was it because you were like... unknowingly exhibiting this internalized anti-blackness.
Yeah,
like,
and you wanted to fit in. Right. Sometimes you want to fit in.
Like, were they making fun of you because you liked anime or was it because you low-key felt like you liking anime made you better than other black people? And I feel like it's usually the latter. Usually the latter.
Or do people just not like you because you're a weirdo?
That too. Like, you might be a know-it-all. Like, like, do they make fun of you because you're smart or because you're a know-it-all and you were condescending?
I'm sorry, intelligence is a black trait as well.
100%.
You know, you don't have to be acting white to be a smart person.
Well, they make fun of you because I like books. It's like, no.
Out of here.
Did you like books or did you used to say, oh, I read books and you make it down? Like,
and
kids are terrible.
And there are real that are like, yo, read books if you want. Like, people really act as if there's people in these streets bullying people for not reading books.
I never got that. Yeah. Listen, I grew up in Rexdale and like some of the dudes would say, like, no, you can't hang out with us because like that's not you.
Right.
You're the one who reads books. Go read your books.
Nobody's getting bullied for reading books. You got bullied because you're a geek.
But
you probably were being a know-it-all and being annoying.
I just feel like, you know, and I guess to answer what you were asking Andre in this question. I found a lot of my foundational knowledge about blackness, feminism, and even black masculinity came from bell hooks, probably about 15 years ago. And one of the first texts of hers that I ever purchased was We Real Cool book, the one on black masculinity. Mm-hmm. And it explores this whole, like, this exhausting dichotomy black men have to go through, hypersexualized, yet, like, on, super cool, yet pressures to do other things. And like, she really traces it, the history of it. And I would recommend that book to anybody. It's not the newest text in the world, but I find it enormously helpful.
One thing that I did want to get into as well is how our parents' politic then becomes a point of conflict with a younger generation. So, you know, especially like if we're the children of first generation immigrants who came here and had to be respectable in order to integrate into the workplace.
Right.
It then becomes they want to foist that politics off on us, that we have to do the same things that they did, even though we're living in a completely different political environment.
Different and the same. And I think that's where the tension comes from.
Yeah. And I think you see that in workplaces, like, you know, multi-generational workspaces where you have people that are millennials and, you know, you're coming to a workplace and there's older black people that work there already and they're probably... maybe trying to give you advice, like it might even be coming from like a good place of them wanting you to be like good in the company. But it's like the ways that they had to move and the ways that we get to move in some respects is it's just different.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I feel like sometimes there can be friction there because they're just like, oh, like how can you come to work with your hair like that? Or how can you come to, like, you know what I mean? Like their idea of what is proper and whatever the case is so different from what we consider. Like, I'm sure there's, you know, older black women that when I worked at a bank, for example, I'm sure they saw me with my Afro and they're probably just like, what is this? Like,
but
what is going on?
They're probably admiring you as well. And we could also thank their generation for helping us be ourselves.
Absolutely.
Like, we don't really have these exchanges in community to get, like, when we exchange in a generational level, I find that it's conflict-based.
Mm-hmm.
We can exchange in love. We can exchange in thankfulness, too.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to read, before we end, just a little. I found a really helpful definition on respectability politics. It's by Damon Young, who's from Very Smart Brothers. He's a very smart brother. But it's from The Root in an interview he did 2 years ago, and he was asked what exactly is respectability politics. And he said, although the concept of respectability politics has existed for a very long time, the term itself is relatively new. Author and professor Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham is credited with first articulating it. It appears in her 1993 book, Righteous Discontent, The Woman's Movement in the Black Baptist Church, 1880 to 1920. It's generally defined as what happens when minority and or marginalized groups are told or teach themselves that in order to receive better treatment from the group in power, they must behave better. So I think really grounding this in, like, it's trauma-based, you know, and discussions like this are really important because, like, we didn't just get here from nowhere.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we taught, that we were taught or that we learned, they do come from a place of survival, but... as the world changes, like, some of those behaviors kind of fell away in certain ways. But yeah, like I said, that older generation, they just kind of, they did it out of survival, and I totally understand.
Sajay, thank you so much for dropping by and loaning your wisdom to us.
Thanks for having me.
Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much for tuning into Black Tea this week. Special shout out to Frequency Podcast Network for housing us and our sister podcast.
Thanks to our show producer, Ryan Clark.
Thank you to our music producer, Black Orchid.
You can catch me on Twitter at Andre Demise.
You can catch me at Melina Williams.
And our guest, Sajay Elder, you can find her at JAE Fiasco.
You can find us on Apple, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts.
And if you like the show, please support us with those 5-star reviews. And if you're feeling extra generous, drop a written review.
Bye.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.